A working visit where the traditional opening turned tense. South Africa's President Cyril Ramaphosa in the lion's den of the Oval Office when Donald Trump first projected a video calling for the killing of whites and then showed press cuttings about murders of white people in South Africa. We'll ask about Ramaphosa's attempt to push back in front of the cameras. Was it an ambush like the one that stung Ukraine's president at the same location back in February? Looming over the tension, the shadow of South African-raised Trump advisor Elon Musk. He's accused Pretoria of anti-white discrimination over a stalled commercial deal to buy his Starlink low-orbit satellite system. Musk's artificial intelligence chatbot, Grok, unprompted musing about a supposed genocide against whites in South Africa, a country with too high a homicide rate for sure, but where in reality it's 1% of the victims that are whites. Trump himself talking up the trope and offering refugee status to whites. Today in the France 24 debate, we're talking about South Africa, the United States, and some hard sell diplomacy. With us from Washington, DC-based South African journalist and columnist Reddy Tlaibi. Thank you for being with us. From Johannesburg, Thembisa Fagute, senior research fellow at the Africa-Asia Dialogues think tank. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
France 24's Jean-Emile Jamin is with us. How are you?
Great, thanks.
And from Washington, also correspondent Fraser Jackson. Fraser, it turned tense. How tense?
Extremely. It's... I would say in normal times we've never seen anything like this, but of course the notion of the Zelensky visit is looming over this visit now. Earlier in the day, I spoke to one of our other colleagues and said that this could really kind of go one or two ways. It could go the best case scenario for Ramaphosa, where they focus more on trade, or if it focused more on the question of the Afrikaners, then it could potentially go south. I don't think any of us were expecting it to go this far south. However, we knew something was up when the schedule changed at the last minute and the working lunch that was meant to take place got pushed in place for the Oval Office gathering, which was normally set to take place after the working lunch. And then when the pool got inside the Oval Office, my friends inside there said that there were TV set up, which again was another bit of a red flag, that's something that we don't normally see in the Oval Office. And for the first 10 or 15 minutes or so, everything kind of seemed normal and even quite jovial. There were jokes being cracked back and forth, but then the questioning started, and as soon as the question of the Afrikaners and what Trump has said without evidence, it should also be noted, is a genocide of the white South Africans, that's when things really took a turn. Trump basically responded to Ramaphosa, who said that Trump needed to listen to the voice of South Africans, and Trump said that he'd brought receipts, literally receipts. He'd brought stacks of papers of alleged articles that he said showed that there was a genocide taking place. He then told the White House aides to lower the lights of the Oval Office and played clips from videos that, again, he said showed the incitement of hatred and violence towards white farmers. At the end of that, it should be noted during it, Ramaphosa was visibly upset. He didn't really look at the television that much, and Ramaphosa pushed back, saying that a lot of those clips were members of the minority parties inside South Africa's political system, and that they don't represent the views of the South African government. I think that was perhaps best put forward by the Minister of Agriculture, who pushed back and said that these people are minority party leaders and that basically the South African government had banded together with other factions to try to ensure that these people and these voices never get into power within South Africa. Trump still, though, pushed back, a bit like a dog with a bone. He refused to take that as an answer, but he did start to listen as things went on, and testimonials from former golfers, from leaders of industry, leaders of trade unions started to give their testimonials. Trump softened a bit and started to listen a bit more to what they were saying. But of course, he has had a steady stream of one side of this debate coming to him from his advisors, and notably one of his main friends, Elon Musk.
Ukraine's president will tell you after that February meeting, it's best to bring reinforcements for an Oval Office sit down. Cyril Ramaphosa appealing to two of Donald Trump's favorites, golfers and fellow billionaires. We heard earlier Africa's second richest man, Johann Rupert, the head of luxury goods conglomerate Richmond, in the company of majors winners Ernie Els and Retief Goosen. We saw amiable exchanges with Trump, who knows both of them. And you were describing just there, Fraser, some of that tense moment. Let's listen back to one moment where we're hearing Cyril Ramaphosa trying to push back.
I would say if there was Afrikaner farmer genocide, I can bet you these three gentlemen would not be here, including my Minister of Agriculture. He would not be with me. So it'll take him, President Trump, listening to their stories, to their perspective. That is the answer to your question.
But, Mr. President, I must
President
say
Trump.
That we have, wait. We have thousands of stories talking about it.
Sure.
And we have documentaries, we have news stories, and that is Natalie here, somebody here to turn that? I could show you a couple of things, and it has to be responded to.
Ready, Clay B, how did Cyril Ramaphosa do?
All right, I do think that he could have been a little bit more forceful with pushing back against the white genocide, because our crime stats in South Africa tell a different story, and it is emphatic, empirical evidence. But I understand from speaking to some of the people who are in that room right now, some of the sources that I've kept in touch with from the South African delegation side, that there was a specific reason somebody like Johann Rupert was there. It was precisely to rather focus on personal experience and narrative, for Johann to be the case study of the issue that South Africa is here to counter. And that is, if there's a white genocide, I'm white, I'm Afrikaner, I own farms, I own land, I've bought farms, and there is no genocide. And any else as well has just bought a property, I understand, in Plettenberg Bay, a very picturesque coastal area. So I think Ramaphosa wanted to step back on the genocide issue rather than sound defensive, and wanted the case studies, the people about whom this whole genocide issue is centered and crafted, to be the ones not only to tell the story or to demonstrate. Number two, I do think that the beginning was quite friendly and cordial. Donald Trump gave Ramaphosa a false sense of security, letting him speak, welcoming him, having that camaraderie, golfers and so on, and laying the case. I thought that the fact that Ramaphosa kind of went back to Trump on the G20, they've publicly boycotted the G20, but there was Ramaphosa using flattery to say to Trump, the G20 that you started, of course we know that it started in 1999 under a different president, but Ramaphosa making it personal so that Trump can be puffed up. However, the change of schedule was significant. It showed that there was a false sense of security and an ambush that was being planned with those videos that President Ramaphosa couldn't counter, using utterances of a 9% party, or is it 8% party, the EFF in South Africa. And it's true, it's not national policy. Ramaphosa did well, but it's not his style to shout and be performative. But I do think he could have interjected a little bit more.
And just as you predicted in a column for the Daily Maverick, bringing on a fellow billionaire, bringing on the golfers, got Trump's attention. What were your thoughts when there was that moment when Johann Rupert called the head of the radical EFF party rabble?
There's no love lost between those two. You know, it's very important to stick to facts. The EFF is a populist party, a very radical nationalist party. So they need a poster boy, I suppose, for the kind of race-based politics. And Johann Rupert, as the second richest man in South Africa, but then Elon Musk, of course, is associated more with the United States than South Africa. But there's no love lost. There's a history there. For many years, the EFF, when lamenting what's going on in South Africa, they would claim that white people are controlling the president. They run the economy. They're hogging the wealth. But if you really look at Johan's contribution in philanthropy, in investing in the youth, and so on, then you would understand that there's a discrepancy. There's a bit of the disinformation and the sensationalism that we see here. There was a very, very vociferous campaign during the Zuma years, Jacob Zuma, former president, where to deflect attention from state corruption, you'd go and find the rich white people and claim that they are the ones who are undermining a black government. And that was false. So Johan Rupert has had an experience with disinformation in South Africa. And Julius Malema is one of those people who have been attacking him. But he told me in a conversation once that he doesn't lose sleep over that. So it was to be expected. I think it was from a geopolitical point of view, I thought it was important for Johan to share that, just to situate Julius Malema in the politics of South Africa. We are living in an era where the louder you are, the more prominence you get. And sometimes it's the fault of the media, the disproportionate attention given to loud people and not looking at where they are situated in South African politics. Ramaphosa was correct. The EFF is an opposition party that has 8 or 9%. They've reduced. They haven't been able to go up into the teens, having started off well. So how much prominence really do you give to that kind of rhetoric and sloganeering that Trump understands? Because he does it too. He says stuff. He's a performer. He does the theatrics. In fact, Donald Trump and Julius Malema would get along because they play to the gallery. They like to hog the spotlight. They like to be threatening and show this machismo. But in terms of what practically happens behind the scenes, there is no way that Julius Malema is influencing government policy on this particular matter. And Johan Rupert was trying to do exactly that, situate him where he belongs. We can't come to the capital of the United States to talk pivotal trade matters, pivotal life and death matters, and just confine the conversation to an opposition party leader of an 8% party when the rest of the policymakers are in the room. Perspective.
To Thembisa Fagudde, there was then that moment where you had a former golfer, Retief Goosen, who said that his own mother had been attacked, that he had the electrified fences around his property, but that he was staying put. What was your thought, Thembisa Fagudde, about what you just saw?
And honestly speaking, I think it went very well. I don't see Donald Trump returning to have this discussion ever again. I was more interested and fascinated by how everyone in the room actually tried to massage his ego by continually saying they need his help. And I think that, to an extent, helped. So my view is the issue was going to come up. The issue had to be ventilated, and it had to be, there was no other way to avoid the type of robust discussion that took place. And I'm of the view that henceforth you are likely to have business commencing between the two countries in earnest, particularly the fact that you had this very significant business people in South Africa in that room. You had the white minister of agriculture also in that room. So Trump is actually on the back foot in this regard. And I don't think he will actually raise this issue ever again. What you are likely to see happening, and this is why Elon Musk decided to reserve his comment, is that we are likely to see some sort of business coming out of this. And I'm glad, actually, that this issue was ventilated in the manner that it was ventilated, because it has been occupying a lot of people's minds for a very long time. And I think President Cyril Ramaphosa, note, of course, we're standing certain discomforts during the debate, he will walk out of that room much more confident that serious business and relations with the United States will begin in earnest. In fact, if you look at Donald Trump's posture, he was not really pushing that hard, because he himself knew that there's an element of mistruth in what he was reading. If you look at the sources of the newspapers, I'm not going to mention names, but some of the sources that I saw, the sources of the newspaper clips or online sites that he was suggesting, these are some of the online that very few people including some of the first-year students, will go and use as references. So I think it's going to be business moving on, and this issue is going to take a back seat.
Okay,
Tembisa. Trying to rectify an issue like
that. Yeah, let's talk about the gorilla in the room. The Bloomberg News Agency reporting that a possible deal for South Africa to finally sign a Starlink contract might be in the works during Ramaphosa's trip to Washington. The government exploring a workaround to what's called the Black Economic Empowerment Laws, post-apartheid laws which demand that 30% black ownership for telecom licensees. If, Tembisa, the deal's not signed, you're saying if the deal is signed, you won't hear Donald Trump talk white genocide anymore? And if it is not signed, he will?
I think what Johan Rupert said was very important. Again, massaging Donald Trump's ego by saying, we need your help, we need Elon Musk's satellite. That resonated with President Cyril Ramaphosa. By the way, the reason why Skylink was not in South Africa, was not done business in South Africa, is technical. It's because of Elon Musk's refusal to accept that there are certain laws that seek to address the injustices of the past. But he's keen on coming back into South Africa, and Donald Trump understands the significance of South Africa, particularly given our rare earth minerals, not only in South Africa, but our influence that we have in other African countries, particularly the DRC, which is going to be key and essential in the next business frontier of AI. So I think it's going to be business as usual. And as I've said, I think this issue was ventilated appropriately, and I don't see Donald Trump going back to raise this discussion again.
Jean-Michel, first off, I have to ask you, when Donald Trump said, dim the lights, I want to show the video, what were you thinking?
It's like cinema, isn't it? I don't think, as Fraser was mentioning, we hadn't seen anything like this until the Zelensky spat. And we were worried that it was going to kind of follow the same way.
But then
we didn't expect a movie.
we'd had Mark Carney, the Canadian Prime Minister at the White House, and that turned out to not be tense. It was diffused quite quickly. So were you surprised?
I was surprised in the manner that it was done, but this is really cinematic politics. It started off as tee off diplomacy with all the golf, and then it turned into something that I personally have never seen following politics. And it really was an uncomfortable 10 minutes or so of just watching Cyril Ramaphosa refused to even look at the TV screen while this was all playing out, knowing what he wanted to respond to Donald Trump, exactly those points which we've mentioned about talking that Julius Malema and the Economic Freedom Fighters are a minority party, and that this doesn't constitute what the rest of South Africa is thinking as a majority, and trying to get that point across to Donald Trump, who just carried on telling him to listen. And then we never really got a word in. And I would love to hear what actually goes on behind closed doors, because that is where the real meat and juice of these talks is going to take place.
And do you agree with Reddy Kalebi? He could have pushed back a little bit more in front of the cameras?
I think this has been the accusation leveled against Cyril Ramaphosa's entire presidency to date. He could have pushed back harder. He could have taken a bolder stance. In that moment, of course, when you are being hosted by the White House in the Oval Office, it's never easy for anyone to really push back in the moment. And I think what was made evident by this exchange, everyone could see Donald Trump pushing those diatribes, pushing that false narrative. It was made evident, and we are just waiting for the resolution of what is going to happen behind closed doors in terms of trade. I personally think Ramaphosa played it very well by not retaliating. He's used to this. You've got to bear in mind that actually the man in question, Julius Malema, those videos, he is part of the reason that Ramaphosa is so well versed in loudmouth politicians. In parliamentary sessions, Julius Malema is the one attacking Ramaphosa. Here, it was Donald Trump giving him a whole lot of accusations and Ramaphosa just having to wait his time, bide his time. I think basically it was just walking the tightrope, and that is very much the strategy that Cyril Ramaphosa has played his entire presidency.
Now, we heard earlier Tembisa Fagude saying that this is now all going to go away. But something strange happened last week. Elon Musk's AI chatbot bringing up the concept of white genocide a lot. For instance, when one Twitter user fact-checked whether Manchester United's Cameroonian keeper Andre Onana loses each time he plays a European final. Underneath, the answer from Grok is about the concept of white genocide. Or when another user ponders the salary of Toronto baseball player Max Scherzer. Same formulaic answer about white genocide. The user points out that the question was about baseball. The chatbot in the comments below apologizes, but then goes on to complete its previous answer about so-called white genocide. Now, Elon Musk's artificial intelligence company then put out a statement that blames the odd responses on, quote, an unauthorized modification that violated XAI's internal policies and core values. It's the fault of some employee. Reddy Klaibe, what were your thoughts on this? I mean, this is pretty serious stuff. This on a major social medium putting forth these baseless theory a lot to everybody. When you see what happened last week, do you agree with Tembisa Fakude that now this will all go away?
You know, I do know from speaking to the South Africans that they believe that the whole motive for the white genocide is Starlink. So I think my response to what my colleague is saying is that, yes, it is an acceptance and an understanding that the South African government is being bullied. They feel that there's an extortionist attempt to bypass the regulatory environment. And I remember at the time that these acerbic attacks were starting against South Africa on X, one of the officials in the presidency said, you know what, if we were to just give him what he wanted with Starlink, this will all go away. Obviously, he wasn't saying, let's do that. He was basically saying, the only reason we have started this whole white genocide thing and it's being amplified and hogging headlines here in the United States, it is because Elon Musk wants a particular outcome and arrangement with South Africa that bypasses the regulatory environment. And South Africa is not unique in insisting on an adherence to some sort of regulatory frameworks. There were protest actions in over environmental concerns, privacy concerns in India, things stalled because he's supposed to partner with local people. There's just requirements everywhere. And because South Africa is a weaker economy than the US, they probably think, okay, we can bully these people. We can bully these people to do as we please. But here's the problem. Here's the problem. Even if Cyril Ramaphosa were to give in to whatever it is that Elon Musk wants today, it won't pass the constitutional test in South Africa. It will be challenged in Parliament, where the EFF, where Julius Malema will be, where Jacob Zuma's MK party will be, where the GNU will be. The party of Cyril Ramaphosa does not have a two-thirds majority. They will be challenged in Parliament. Even if they had the two-thirds majority, you have another layer, the Constitutional Court. Just because Trump is ignoring the courts here doesn't mean Cyril Ramaphosa can get away with it in South Africa. So just coming back to what Trump is using, to what Elon Musk is using his platform for, it is absolutely soul-destroying that lies can live on that platform unfiltered. And when you have Grok, that is meant to be a mechanism of fact-checking that he claimed he wanted. He claimed he wanted free speech, but there he is, tailoring dialogue to suit his commercial interests. Let's not forget that. It was extraordinary when Grok started correcting itself after spending months being strident in pushing back against the white genocide narrative. But obviously, Elon Musk didn't like the fact that his very own creation was fact-checking him in real time, and he decided to manipulate it so that it sounded like a robot just saying, we need to be careful with white genocide and all. But it just shows something that is a bit more dark and nefarious, that we are living in an age, really, where we are losing control over our grip on truth, or rather not losing control, but it simply means for those of us who are public commentators and journalists, we ought to wake up and realize that the fight against disinformation has just taken on another level, because it means even platforms that are meant to push back against disinformation are now being manipulated to be lethargic in fulfilling that duty. We have a lot of work to do, and it's not just in South Africa. It just means everywhere in the world, wars can be started based on this. Misconceptions, prejudice, matters that have dangerous consequences can now no longer be filtered because systems are being manipulated to further the divisive rhetoric.
Tembisa Fakude, this goes quite far because we could show you the B-roll if you like, of the State Department briefing just from Tuesday, where the spokesperson there doubled down on the idea of offering refugee status to white South Africans. By the way, I think it's somewhere, according to what media source you choose, 49 or 59 Afrikaners who have come to the United States, not thousands, as was stated during the meeting. That's the official number. But will Donald Trump dial this back? Otherwise put, is it really just about a commercial deal, or is it ideological?
It is about a commercial deal, and it just didn't fly within the Afrikaner community in South Africa. You're talking about at least, some estimates are saying 7 million Afrikaners, and out of the 7 million, 8,000 responded to the invitation, and 47 were accepted to the United States. It's quite embarrassing, actually. This is the first time in the history of the United States where you have the United States inviting people to come to the United States and they flat out reject the invitation. And this is what has happened. It was not a large scale response from the Afrikaner community and jumping onto the opportunity and going to the United States. So it is actually, or it has backlash against Donald Trump. And I think it's something that worth writing about. That South Africa is probably the first country in the world where people have been given opportunity to apply for a green card and they say, no, thanks very much, we're not interested, we're much more comfortable where we are. That's the first point. And the second point, I think the premise, the assumption that we are having this discussion based on facts, based on logic, again, is to an extent misdirecting this discussion. The premise of this is baseless. And the fact that even President Cyril Ramaphosa, well, he had no choice, entertained a discussion based on this laughable facts and premise, that in itself was, well, show of respect by Cyril Ramaphosa. But I think there could have been a much more, as Reddy says, a stronger pushback in terms of ridiculing these assumptions. But the strategy that Cyril Ramaphosa had of bringing in the surrogates, in inverted commas, in the form of the golfers and Johan Rupert, I think it worked. If Cyril Ramaphosa was with his cabinet, he would have been much, much more embarrassed. And as I said earlier on, I think this is the end of it. I don't see it continuing.
But
I think
that's perhaps the end of it from a King. South African side. But from the United States side, what if, you know, this is an, you know, ideologically, this administration doubles down on some call it nativist, some would call it a racist view of the world.
Well, they'll have to come to South Africa and start advertising and attracting the so-called refugees to the United States because there hasn't been applications. The Afrikaners who Donald Trump claims are being persecuted did not take the opportunity. We know that, as I've said, 7 million plus Afrikaners, 8,000 applied and 47 were accepted. So there's no appetite from the South Africans, so-called refugees, who want to go to the United States. And I think if the United States wants to prove a point that it was correct, it will really go in a, it will have to go in a serious public marketing campaign to try, number one, convince the Afrikaners themselves in South Africa that they are persecuted, and to make it easy for them to go to the United States, which I think is going to be laughable.
But Jameen, when Donald Trump is speaking, he's not trying to convince South Africans. He's speaking to a domestic audience there.
Yes, he's basically catering to his Republican base, who latches on to those right-wing talking points that were even brought to them by the right-wing Afrikaans group, AfriForum, Ernst Roots as well, the former head there who took them to the White House previously with Tucker Carlson. These are all just talking points which really play to his base. And the louder he shouts about them, regardless of the facts that actually underlie them, he can whip out as many pages that he had them. It doesn't matter. It absolutely serves its purpose. So facts don't really matter when it comes to, we really are used to this presidency. And I think really wants to just add to that point.
Ready, Tlaibi?
Yes, that is why Donald Trump, I agree with that point. It is a brilliant point that he's playing to his base. That is why he's able to be cordial and diplomatic when Cyril Ramaphosa arrives and they talk about golf and their friends and all of that. And then he just switches. It's like a bipolar moment, two personalities, you know, because he reads the room. He knows where this attitude, this gung-ho attitude doesn't belong. He creates a false sense of safety, but he knows that his base probably don't want him normal, sophisticated, debonair, diplomatic. They want a fighter, and that's what he gives them.
And what to make, speaking of reading the room, of Elon Musk? How would you read it going forward? Is Elon Musk, if we follow the logic there of Thembisa Fakude, is he about doing deals as well, or is it about something else? He's got a long history with South Africa, having grown up there.
You know, I try not to pay attention to Elon Musk, but I know that we can't avoid him. I don't think he's ideological at all, but I do think that when we look at his utterances around the role of AI, where power lies, how much he wants to control the world. And I think that if I were to look at him through the political lens, he does remind me of a lot of some of these Afrikaners who are falsely pushing this narrative. They are nostalgic, crying over a bygone era where they didn't have to share space with people who look like me. That's what this is about. This narrative that we've given our land to the black man and they don't know what they're doing. So I do think there's a sense where somebody feels like they lost their supremacy in the world, that political control in South Africa is in different hands, and that black people have agency and decision-making power in South Africa. So I just think that there's an axe to grind, and just having that last word and not liking where South Africa's political trajectory went, so settling scores. It can't just be about Starlink, because in all of that, there's Starlink, yes, but I'm wondering whether there is some nostalgia for the place of white people in South Africa during apartheid, a place that they, those who are lamenting this, would interpret as having been lost. Meanwhile, the rest of us, you didn't lose anything. You got to recognize that you share a country with other people who don't look like you.
Jameen.
Well, this talks to who Musk has surrounded himself with in recent times. I think if we think back of his friends who went with him from South Africa, the PayPal Mafia.
Yeah, explain what the PayPal Mafia is for our viewers.
A group of South Africans who really made it big, Southern Africans as well. There was Peter Thiel, who was from Namibia. They all came from backgrounds which had some sort of a favoring to the system that they were benefiting from, and that was apartheid, that was in Southwest Africa, which was Namibia, and in certain towns which even had empathetic Nazi symbolism, if you can say that. There was Elon himself, there was his friend David Sachs, Peter Thiel, and the grandson of Pukbuta, who was the Prime Minister at the time of South Africa, and very much under the apartheid regime. They all went to America and they all made it really big and they started PayPal. And between them, they have basically enforced this rhetoric of harking back, as really says, to this time where things were simple, things were normal. They benefited from the system. Why can't things go back to the way that they were? And we're seeing this, well, we've seen it really in recent years with Elon Musk. He has changed from his Democrat stance to his Republican and Donald Trump lapdog kind of a style. And it's quite interesting how now you're seeing in every single part of his rhetoric referring to South Africa, that harking back to a time which would have benefited him.
Lapdog or pit bull?
Well, it's something that the economic freedom fighters alluded to in their pre-match report, basically that Johan Rupert and Elon Musk were the two presidents presiding over their proxies, if you can, in terms of Ramaphosa and Donald Trump. But it's Elon Musk doesn't seem to be at least in the forefront of what we're seeing right now. We will see with Starlink, but he is actually taking a step back now from his Doge compliances, which was a big part of what we saw in terms of cutting back for USAID, which is quite an important point for something that South Africa is no longer benefiting from. So it remains to be seen if Elon Musk can be roped back in. Maybe South Africa can benefit and get those USAID cuts repealed as well.
Tembisa Fakude, Elon Musk may be leaving the White House, but he'll still have Donald Trump's ear, we can presume. And just going forward now, South Africa, which on the one hand is this member of the BRICS that has warm ties with Russia, that has also ties with China, it's its number one trading partner ahead of the U.S., which has called out Israel in front of the International Court of Justice. And yet, Ramaphosa also, who wants to do business with the United States and wants that handover of the G20 to be meaningful. Which way forward for South Africa on that score? Which way are South Africans looking?
I think the first pass, of course, will be to have Donald Trump coming to South Africa. The suspicions the talk has been that Donald Trump might just snub G20, but I think he will come. And I think Cyril Ramaphosa, knowing him, he's going to continue massaging his ego behind the closed doors. Donald Trump is transactional in nature. He has said himself that he's not interested in wars. But I think the four other speakers who spoke after President Cyril Ramaphosa emphasized the need for partnership between the United States and South Africa. And Donald Trump was nodding when all of those statements were made by the four other speakers. So you are likely to have Donald Trump initiating and agreeing with some of the proposals that will come. But importantly, I think Elon Musk, who did not want to be involved in this discussion, is hoping that his businesses are going to go steam ahead in South Africa. I was also surprised that the issue of RCJ was brushed off by Donald Trump. I would have expected that to be part of the discussion. And I think the other most important issue, of course, is that South Africa is one country that you didn't expect to be sitting in the Oval Office today. But the events of the past couple of weeks, including Trump speaking to Ahmad al-Sharaa of Syria and uplifting the sanctions, talking to Iran and all the advances that we've seen happening, to me signals a new posture in terms of foreign relations of the United States towards the so-called arch enemies of Israel. And I think this is what is going to determine the relationship moving forward. It's going to be business. And I think Elon Musk has found himself now with a foot in terms of negotiating and pushing his weight within the South African government. And he's likely to get what he wants.
Reddy Tlabi, this could be a lot of news cycles between now and the G20 at the end of the year. What's your prediction? Will Donald Trump go to South Africa?
I think he will. I think he will go to South Africa, not just because of South Africa, but because there's life outside of the U.S.-South Africa relationship. The G20 was started in 1999. It encompasses 20 economies. It is much bigger than South Africa. A year is very little to jeopardize such a global platform that is also very good for Donald Trump. And remember, he's a showman. He would love to take over the presidency in that big pageantry ceremonial manner. And there'll be other people there besides South Africa. So I do think that the beginning of it, you know, publicly boycotting Rubio not going, the Treasury Secretary not going, okay, fine. It was a particular time in South Africa at the time. Benjamin Netanyahu had just been to the U.S. Capitol, and it was important not to offend him. He came back. again, there was some action against South Africa. Now it looks like it's a bit quiet. Back to your point about the ICJ case just being glossed over. So I just think that the way Ramaphosa smoothly and expertly personalized it, made it about Donald Trump, not the U.S. He didn't say the U.S. started the G20. He said, you did it. You did it. So it's important I hand over to you in that Cyril Ramaphosa way. And he was nodding and he was very happy. And I don't know if you noticed that immediately thereafter, Trump picked up on the G20 thing and said, we're going to be together. We're going to meet. And so I think he signaled his presence, at least. But in January or February, when they made these big announcements that they were boycotting it, it was very early on in the presidency, and they had to make a big a show of force. But I predict that something more constructive and adult will happen.
All right, a prediction of adult events happening. That's refreshing. Reddy Tlabi, we're going to have to leave it there. That's a good ending. Tembisa Fakoudi, I want to thank you for joining our conversation, as well as Jean-Emile Jamin. Thank you for being with us here in the France 24 debate.